One of the things that I've been very quick to say, as we've done this research in about 60-some countries around the world, and we've interviewed about 600 of the persecuted, some of them like the Soviet Union. We looked at persecution that's been a historical reality from 1917, places like China, North Korea, working our way back through Islam. Among Islam, it's particularly true that we find among college students, university students around the world, they are probably the most responsive segment of Islam that we find to Jesus. Now, that's the good news. There's a couple of bad newses here. The number one motivation for Muslims coming to Jesus is that they hate their father and they hate their culture. And we have been baptizing that, putting that into leadership without being aware that it's got a very dark side to it. Now, when I say what we're going to do a couple things that we're framing. Welcome. This material. What we're seeing around the world, if we had, I don't know how many people are in this room, but let's say if there was 100 of you in this room and you were MBBs, Muslim background believers, then 95 of you would be guys and only 5 of you would be women. So you can see endemically what probably one of the largest, the two largest missiological issues that we've got in Islam today, from our point of view, number one is women are not reaching women. Christianity has a male face almost the same as Islam has a male face. That's not good news. All right? That's not good news. We have believed for years that if we reach the men, we'd reach their wives. That's not true. And I can't break all that out with you. But what I wanted to say to you is what we are finding around the world is that the most responsive segment of this religious group are the students. That's the good news. The bad news is I only know of one case where it's ever, in my world, has led to the establishment of a church. All right? Now, what I want you to hear me say very carefully is, as far as North Africa, Middle East is concerned, and Beth and I are concerned in our world of what we call the Red Sea Cluster, we want to quadruple, multiply many times over our efforts among university and college students. That's one of the quickest ways to reach the nations that I know of. But what we need help from you, and what we're saying on our side of the world is that we need to do a better job, is that make sure that it has a church planting mentality, because what we're finding is that faith very seldom survives going home to mom and dad, getting a job, and generally getting a wife, occasionally getting a husband. And so what we're not doing a good job of overseas, and that's not your fault, it's as much our fault as anybody, is we've not put a church planting DNA strand into reaching university students. We're going to change that. And when we reach these 20-somethings, y'all tell me if you can't hear. I just hate the box. Is it okay? Can you hear in the back? Not so good? Okay, I'm back in the box. What we're finding is we want to help them when they come to Christ, when they have spiritual conversations. We help them from the very beginning know of ways of incarnating their faith as they go back on holidays, as they go to the villages, as they go to the cities, as they're with their mom and dad. But you've got to hear your Uncle Nick in saying this. I witness to university students all the time. I have learned up front that this hatred of father and culture is so real that early on in the witness discipleship encounters, I will say to them, praise the Father, you've come. The Lord wants to draw you to Himself. You know, I'm making some of this conversation up, but you'll get the gist of it. And perhaps the main reason that God has drawn him to yourself is so that you will go home and reach your father. In a unbelievably significant percentage of the times, these young men will say to me, if I have to take this to my father, then I'm not interested. Hell's a good place for my dad. And we need to know this. You need to know this. It's not something that we can gloss over. And what we found, and it doesn't matter whether you're Southern Baptist, Assemblies of God, Mennonites, it's been across the world. We have been praying the prayer of salvation with and bringing into baptism these young men who have almost a pathological hatred for father and culture. You all know, as we say in Kentucky, that dog won't hunt. That's not going to go anywhere. That's not going to translate into kingdom type stuff. And so what you need to hear me say is we've got to reach college students. God has not made an exception for university students in the Great Commission, has He? And like in Addis Ababa, in the university there, we probably have 80 people groups represented in that university alone. Now, what happens, missionaries are, we often can be very narrow-minded. We all rush to the newest big thing, and just as quickly, if it doesn't work quick, we leave it. And we've left, in a lot of cases, the university ministries too quickly. And so what I want you to hear me say again is, college students around the world are just like the ones you work with. They are, as I've said before, attracted to the forbidden. They come to university as Muslim university students, and they eat pork, drink alcohol, have sex, and become a Christian. All right? And they're all about the same thing. And very little of this then translates into going home. It's more an experiment. But it's a wide open door that we want to take advantage with. But we've got to learn early on in that discipleship relationship to have the real conversations with them. Talk about who mom and dad is. Talk about taking the gospel home with them. And we're beginning to see some fantastic results. I was teaching this material to about 12 organizations in Sudan 3 or 4 weeks ago. Beth and I were. At night, they took me out in a very isolated part of Khartoum, and I taught the material basically to about 30, 35 Muslim background believers, MBBs. 30 of them were men, 5 of them were women, just like the picture is globally. I remember right down front is sharing these things with you about, here's let me tell you what you guys have said to me about what motivates you to come to Christ. How most of you as single young men come to Christ because you want to get out of your culture. You hate your father. You're hoping we will educate you, take you to America, help you find a wife. It's all this package of what we call Jesus Plus. You get Jesus Plus a wife, Jesus Plus a job. And university students in Islam are no different from this scenario. But in the front, one young lady began to weep during some of the times we were sharing. And she said, Uncle Nick, my family almost beats me every night. Am I allowed to fight back? That's a dynamic question. That's a good question. And as the group allowed the group to interact in her life, they really talked about what it meant to be followers of Jesus. 4 young brothers came up to me afterwards and said, listen, we've been here for 5 years. We all came to Khartoum, to the university. We've all found Christ. No one has ever told us we have responsibility to reach our family. Isn't that sad? I don't know how many years they've been believers. They said, we are packing tonight. We will go back to our village. There are 12 others in our immediate family. We'll come back to Khartoum once our families are baptized into Jesus. That's pretty cool. And so what I'm asking you to do is 2 things. Understand that their motivations, when you get on that side of the pond, their motivation for coming to Christ, sometimes there's some pretty horrific junk in there. And secondly, we've got to do a much, much better job of setting the expectations for them more than just their coming to Jesus in a college environment. Your job is to plant a church in your home, in your village, in your city, and up front have that expectation built into them, and we can do a whole lot better job. I want to leave that for a moment. Beth, you're going to get her up there, aren't you? Oh, you're not going to get it up there. This is our Windows research program, and I have been thrilled this week, and maybe you've already heard this in another environment, of how you all are working so hard in this arena in Life Impact to give your students a heart for evangelism. When in best of my generation coming through the International Mission Board, generally the couple of things that kept you from being appointed was health issues. Back then, everybody had to have a master's in divinity, and it was a health and education type issues. The number one thing that keeps missionaries from being appointed today is they've not led anybody to Christ. That's pretty tough, isn't it? Why in the world do you want to go on a mission field when you haven't led anybody to Christ? And so that, but it shows you the cocoon that so many of our people grow up in, that generally the number one thing that delays their appointment is to get them to seal the contract and lead somebody to Christ. Many of them have been devout, wonderful witnesses, but they just don't know how to close the deal. They don't know how to actually get to the point of conversion with a person where they would pray the prayer and continue the process. I'll tell you a fun story. When Beth and I were in the university setting from 1997 to 2000, I chose four guys to disciple from what we learned from the persecuted. The persecuted teach us you choose your disciples. Jesus chose his disciples. Paul chose Timothy. There's nothing more strategic in my world than to choose strategically who you want to disciple. That's big news. Beth chose three young ladies, eventually another one. All of those married each other. We did not set that up. They're all on the mission field now as career. But I remember the day when Ben and Justin and Tim came to me and they said, "Okay, Nick, we want to know." I said, "What do you want to know?" They said, "We want to know, how do you disciple somebody in Morocco?" I said, "Guys, how do you disciple an African American here in this Kentucky area?" And they said, "We don't know." I said, "Well, you better find out." And they came back about 2 weeks later and they said, "Okay, Nick, how do you disciple an African American in a different culture from us in this Kentucky area?" I said, "Well, guys, how do you disciple somebody on the college campus that's just like you?" And they said, "We don't know." I said, "Well, you better go find out." And so what these three guys did, two of them joined the most wicked fraternity on that college campus, and within one semester, every Thursday night, they had 260 college students in a Bible study. They figured it out. You know, but they figured it out at home first. And the other guy moved out of his dorm into a trailer park, lived among what he would call trailer trash, and he started a church that has about 300 members there today. And he was robbed, he was pushed around, everything. But when those guys tried to figure it out in their own college environment, that was the best preparation. Leading people to Jesus is the best preparation for leading Muslims to Jesus or anybody else around the world. But that's not what we're doing. James Merritt, in his sermon to the Southern Baptist Convention in 2000, I got a copy of it and read it, said 90% of Southern Baptists, born and bred in our churches, birth there, grow up there, won to Christ there, baptized, married, and buried there, 9 out of every 10 will never share their faith with another person. That's horrible. That's horrible. And so that's the environment in which you live and in which you're trying to have spiritual conversations. And so one of the things that recently we learned from using the camel method among Muslims that has revolutionized the way that I look at training my people, one of my friends, Kevin Greeson, says there's four things we have to answer, four questions we have to answer to get our people to evangelize. And as I've heard you all suggest a number of things this week, this is my little commercial because it's just helped me so much in the past few months. Number one, if you answer these four questions in any culture, your people will evangelize. Number one is, what do I say? You know, what is my story? Beth and I are in a world to which you cannot hand out a tract. You can't proof text your testimony. You cannot even really use the book. But our world is, our people, we're mentoring them in what we call situational storying. When somebody asks me a story, whether it's about the Trinity or whatever it might be, I'm going to tell them a Bible story. And when they ask me a question about that story, guess what I'm going to do? I'm going to tell them another story. So answering questions with Bible stories has become a remarkable witnessing tool. Our problem is what? Most of our folks don't come out knowing enough Bible that when they're asked a question, they can tell a story, and they're asked another question, they can tell another story. We don't have use of our Bible. Getting college students not just to proof text the Bible, but to be able to tell the stories of the Bible is an awesome, awesome tool. Number one thing you got to answer, first thing you got to answer is, what do I say? Secondly, is who do I say it to? For us, we're looking for the Loises, the Apostle Pauls. We're looking for the movers and shakers in that culture, for the men and women and family of peace. We do not want necessarily to throw our pearls among the swine. We want to invest in people who are going to be the bridge people in that culture. And so you figure out, what do I say? The second thing is, figure out, who do I say it to? Let me give you a commercial real quick. This is what's in the material. Across the world, we now know how truth travels the quickest. Upon whose shoulders? Whether you're a veterinarian, a pharmacist, a farmer, a plumber, a missionary, whatever. Truth travels the quickest when the truth carrier has as many of these five characteristics as possible. Generally, they're going to be male, over 30, married with a job and the head of their household. So what we're doing is Jesus at 12 years of age knew who he was in the kingdom. But he didn't even start his ministry till after 30 years of age. By the time Jesus did his earthly ministry, he was still male. He was over 30, carpenter, head of his household. God doesn't get married. We have 4 out of 5. And generally, truth is going to soar. 90% of all the Muslim background believers in the world are 22 years of age. They have no job, no wife, no status, no head of the household. And Jesus himself did not try to start a movement with that. You see what I'm saying? So when you're looking for what do I say and who do I say it to, we're generally saying try to look for women and men that have as many of these cultural characteristics as possible. And that's just how truth travels in most cultures. The third thing we need to know is, one, what do we say? Who do we say it to? And who's going to hold me accountable to whether or not I say it? The IMB is working very hard on this. Generally, we're only held accountable for baptisms. We can make those up really easy. What we're trying to do on the mission field, which I think that you all would applaud because I see it in your hearts and faces also, is every time Beth and I walk into a home, we reserve the right and the opportunity. We do this all the time. Ask our missionaries, who's on your heart? How many people have you witnessed to this week? In monthly reports, we ask how many spiritual conversations. Who's going to hold me as a strategy associate to those spiritual conversations? Without accountability in a small group, we generally do not find people witnessing. We do find a lot of accountability in very healthy marriages where the husband, we have one wife who has 28 Muslim women name on the refrigerator, and almost weekly her husband queries her about those names, who she's visited, how deep she's going with them, how can he pray for her and for them. That's pretty doggone cool. But so what do I say? Who do I say it to? Who holds me accountable to saying it? And the fourth one in my world is particularly significant. What do I do when they say yes? If 25 Muslims were to say yes to most missionaries, we'd have a heart attack. What do we do now? And therefore, again, is why we like to come to the Life Impact world. You guys are doing small groups. You are knowing the essence of movements is in small Bible studies, house groups, house churches. And so we're saying every missionary has to be involved in a small group and lead a small group. So they can model what house churches and small groups look like. And again, we pray for God to send a great harvest, and we act as if God will never send a great harvest. And if God was to give us 2,000 to 3,000 believers like he did at Pentecost, he'd give us extreme diarrhea. What would we do with them? What do we do? Where do we send them? Well, how do we gather them? Who's going to baptize them? And so we are acting and structuring ourselves as if God will not answer our prayers. We're going to get over this. We got to get over it. And so for us, as we go among our missionaries, and some have been on the field many years, we're trying to work with them in these four questions, these four issues. What do we say? Who do we say it to? Who's going to hold me accountable to saying it? And what do I do if they say yes? Okay? Now, with folks that are coming out of your ministry, there are a couple questions I want to ask of you, and I really do want feedback, because I don't know how to answer your students when they come to our world. And I'm meeting your students. Beth and I teach about every 2 years in Thailand. We teach about every year in the Philippines. We're all across North Africa, Middle East. We're meeting your students in seminaries. And some of the things that they're asking us, almost without exception, if I come to your world, who's going to mentor me? All right, that's in their DNA that's coming out of this world. Missionaries are hearing that statement as they're saying, well, by the time you come as journeymen and ISCers and career people, we're wanting you to win others to Christ and mentor them. And they're not making this connect. When your students are saying to us, who's going to mentor me? What are they really saying? What do I need to hear? Because I'm hearing it dozens and dozens of times. Would you all give me some feedback and tell me, what are they asking for? Is it direct supervision? Is it for direct Paul and Timothy relationship? What are we looking for here? Huh? You're looking for teamwork. They're looking to be... Right. Have you all got that USA article on the Y generation? Someone sent it to us about a month ago. It scared the socks off of me. I have more in common with Muslims than I do with the Y generation coming out of America. And they want to come in team. They like flexibility. They will get into arguments just for the sake of getting attention. They don't have to have conclusions to the arguments. And older missionaries are just going nuts, you know. And there's just a whole list of things that are coming out of this Y generation. So they want to go as teams. In this thing where they're saying, mentor me, what are they saying to us? What do I need to hear?
I think they're looking for somebody to really cast vision to them and then show them how they fit into that.
A real good vision. Because what we're hearing is they're wanting Paul and Timothy, what the field is hearing, they want Paul and Timothy to walk together every day. And what we've got is, like in our world, I just came from Sudan. Southern Baptists have 6 teams there. 5 teams have 1 couple on it. And what they want to do, they want to start like 20 new teams. And so sending people into isolated areas, it's hard to have that mentoring relationship. And we're struggling when we get 12 of your students and I have 3 couples in 1 country, how to develop team and a mentoring relationship that feels good to them. Does that make sense to you? And I feel like, I sense that I'm not meeting the needs of students that you're sending me at times.
Most of our students are much more comfortable with forming, quote, relationships over electronic means, over
right.
distance means.
Right.
And so, even if that direct contact is not possible, weekly meeting, things like that, just the knowledge that somebody is talking to them regularly, feeding into them, that they can run to them with answers. Our students are not really strong at their trust in themselves. Our culture has not developed a strong trust in themselves. And so they need somebody that they can go to and say, am I doing this right? And it doesn't necessarily have to be somebody who is right there on the spot, but it's somebody that is very quickly available through some kind of connection.
Good. In Ethiopia, they just changed our internet connection from 28 to 40. If we pay another $120, we can go up to 60. So we're not highly connected yet. It's not working really well. Are we giving up, Beth? Well, we can do it in 208. yes.
I think part of it's a judgment on us, too, that they haven't been that well mentored.
All right, I'm going to repeat what you said. He says part of it's a judgment on you all that you haven't been well mentored here. What we're struggling with, what NAME is trying to do, Beth and I particularly, we believe that Jesus sent by twos, not by ones. And we're at the point where we will never, Beth and I will never send a single guy or single girl out there by themselves again. It doesn't work. And we believe that couples are not two, they're one. And it's hard for couples to hold themselves accountable. But the stress that we're under is the pressure of hundreds of million people without the access to the gospel and sending 6 people over here as a team, which would leave 2 more people groups without any witness whatsoever. But the thing is, it's not working sending people by yourself. It just doesn't work. I have 1 couple on the edge by themselves that are staying healthy. So we're trying to send by twos. We're not believing that couples are two. We're trying to send by teams. Praise God, the IMB has taken the ceiling off of appointments to where we can bring out people like from Focus and others as teams. But part of the struggle that we're under is in 1997, we had 175 missionaries in North Africa and Middle East. We have now 453, and we have the same budget we had in 1997. That's not brain surgery, is it? All right? So split your pie. We were splitting 175 ways. We're now splitting it 450 some ways. And 1 vehicle that goes to the bush in Ethiopia cost me $100,000. I have no choice. To put 10 missionaries out among peoples who have no Christian witness, I need $1 million for the first 10 couples. So what I'm doing, I'm just sharing with you some of the issues that we've got. What we've done in North Africa, Middle East is start the FLAME program. And this is part of what I want you to really hear. In the Red Sea cluster, we have a FLAME Horn and a FLAME Yemen. FLAME Horn covers Ethiopia, Somalia, Eritrea, Djibouti, and then Flame Yemen covers Yemen. It is a direct mentoring program for journeymen and ISC couples that I have an interest, at least an interest, we hope more than an interest, in career missionaries, in career missions. It's a direct mentoring program to help us grow them as missionaries. And they come out with a lot of flexibility. They'll get into language. If it's in Yemen, they can go right into Arabic. And then they have a lot of flexibility then to choose which team that they will join that's up and running, already existing team. But that Flame couple, who's my best frontliners in all of Yemen, will mentor them for the 2 years. We've just got through our first year of that. It is exceeding all my expectations. With Roger and Marge Lewis in Yemen. In Ethiopia, it's run by James and Jennifer Lyles. They get a 15 out of 10. It's unbelievable. And they're mentoring these young people and young couples when they get off the planes. Now, we have 80 languages in Ethiopia, so we have to spend about 2 months in Flame Horn choosing a team among the Orthodox, among the Muslims, among the Somali, in some of our major cities, and then you learn a language specific to that team. But it's a strong, direct mentoring relationship, and it is answering a lot more of who's going to mentor me type questions. When they come out just as ISC or journeyman and they're giving a specific task to do, see, Flame is more relational than it is task-oriented. I like that. And it's our investment in those folks for the next 20 or 30 years. If they come out taking a specific task, then your direct supervision might not be as strong. We're hearing the number one complaint to the IMB from ISCers and journeymen is a lack of supervision on the M field, a lack of mentoring. And we're trying to get our missionaries to step up and do it, but I'm overworking them so much. And their number one complaint is discipleship takes a lot of time. And you're asking me to stop discipling Somalis and mentoring Somalis in Afar to mentor these ISC and journeymen. I'm saying yes, because I want to multiply you 20 times over. You know, even if we have to neglect discipleship among the peoples, among the nations for a year or so, let's get 20 and 30 more teams up and running. So this mentoring thing is, if we can find a way, they're getting off the plane. They're going to ISC journeyman conferences, and they're over again. I probably have heard it 20 times in the last year and a half. Who will mentor me? And I want to say two things. Here's our expectations. You will have, not a supervisor, you will have a mentor that will pour their lives into you appropriately. But we're also, our expectations are, as you get language and culture, you'll lead people to Christ and you'll be mentoring others also. It's just not pouring into you and stopping. But what I hear your students saying, I'm a third generation disciple of Max. I'm a fourth generation disciple of this person. So it looks like in a lot of ways it's working here. The other thing that you can help us with, back in my generation, we were all preacher boys. We came through seminary. We came through churches where we had been chewed on by professionals. We had learned conflict management. This whole generation of tent makers does not know how to handle conflict. They don't know how to do it. And this is whether they're 30 years of age or 22 years of age. They don't know how to do the Matthew 18 stuff. When they have a problem, how to go to brother, sister, solve it, bring more people in it. If you all can help us, you know, put them in conflictual situations, if that's an actual word, and help them get the tools. Listen, you get out there on the edge of lostness, which is what's happening, and the bad guys have guns, and the bad guys are radical Islam, and you start getting stressed, you're not going to chew on the guy with a gun. You're going to chew on your team member. And so giving them skills on how to manage conflict and how to be, like I like to say, Jesus was full of truth and grace. If you can give them kind of balance. The other thing is, I'm sharing with you, is help me know what they're saying, first of all, when they say, I need somebody to mentor me. Secondly, how to do this evangelism on four fingers. That was number one. Number two was mentor me. Number three was managing conflict. The other thing that we see that probably brings the most heartache, especially for your ladies that you're sending, is when they come without their parents' blessing. Now, if their parents are not believers, that's tough to get. But especially when you send your children to people of color around the world, especially dads who send their daughters, Beth and I spend hours and hours and days with broken young ladies and oftentimes broken young men who have had to be obedient to the call of God in their lives but somehow could not come with the blessings of their father. Is there a way you can go home with college students? Is there a way that we can continue to gather? Beth and I, when we do commissioning programs for summer missions, I always ask to meet with the parents either before or after the commissioning session, and I talk to them about the necessity and the glory of giving their children their blessings. If you can help parents bless their children in coming our way, all kinds of spiritual fruit will be released, okay? All right. Now, I wanted to give something out to you. It's just not going to do it. I should have brought... If I could get you to help me, I'm going to do some self-serving things here. And you might want to give it to a third person or something. Thank you, Max. A big portion, this is really self-serving. I'm giving you a letter of introduction here to what a workshop looks like that we come to seminaries, college campuses, churches, associations, mission organizations around the world. We do this 5 times a year at MLC. It's just an introduction letter to what a three to four day workshop would look like that brings the nations to your students, to your church, to your association, to you as a group of campus ministers. And it shares from the heart of the persecuted how to share your faith, how to plant small groups, house churches, in the midst of persecution, and do this ministry in such a way that when persecution comes, it's for who Jesus is and not because of the outside missionary, okay? And so we have lined up, hopefully, for 207. All of 206 is booked except the end of 206 is some workshops. We're hopefully in Texas or other places. Also in Kentucky, maybe. We will do this for a 3 to 4 day workshop for campus ministers. Appreciate y'all's hard work. We do this again for everybody that's going to the field. And again, it might sound self-serving, but it's not highlighting best in my ministry. From the heart of the persecuted, they want to teach us how to embrace suffering as a missiological, biblical principle. And how, you know, most Americans that we work with, I like to say trite little comments like, you know, most of us, if we find that Joseph was unjustly arrested and thrown in Pharaoh's prison, we will do everything in our power to get Joseph released before he has a chance to interpret Pharaoh's dream, and therefore both Egypt and Israel perishes. How can we develop in our college students, in our churches, in our pastors, in ourselves, the wisdom and the spiritual sensitivity to know when Joseph needs to stay in jail, especially when it's my Joseph? Or my son. And the mentality from the West is persecution is bad. Persecution is to be avoided at all costs. Now listen, we got two problems on the mission field. We've got people who run from persecution. They're a problem. But if you've got people that like persecution, get them psychological help. All right? It's not that we want you to send us people that love persecution. They've got real problems. All right? We just want to say persecution is a reality of the worlds in which you're sending your sons and daughters and your students. It's just a normal part of life. And how can we help them begin to develop a missiology of suffering that will allow them to stay the course when Joseph gets thrown in jail, when their fruit gets hammered, when their children die, when innocents are slaughtered because Jesus shows up, was part of the point I was trying to make this morning. And so by this self-serving letter, the IMB, particularly North Africa, Middle East, is going to reduce Beth and I, my administrative responsibilities, which is about to kill us right now because we're traveling so much, to make us available to folks like you to lead these 3 and 4 day workshops, to become even a greater partner with you, to say, let us describe what our world looks like, what we need to embrace that world, and hopefully build upon what you're already doing. So this is your letter from Beth and I to say, if there's any way we can serve you on your campus, in a workshop with college students, for a group like this, it would thrill our hearts it usually just takes us about a year to get it on our schedule, okay? Here's some kind of things that we would show with you. Let's look at Pentecost. Let me do the most non-Baptist thing I can do and talk about Pentecost right now, okay? And I want to look at Pentecost. This is what we'll do with your students once they get on the field, too. And part of the issue. I want to look at Pentecost. I know it's a historical reality. I know it happened in Acts chapter 2. But my belief is that God wants Pentecost to come in every people group, every country, every segment of the world now. And His Spirit wants to go over them. Here's the problems we're facing on the mission field. I get on an airplane, and Beth and I serve in responsive Africa, where they've always had churches, they've always had denominations, and all of a sudden we get on a plane, overnight we're in Somalia. And we're in what I want to call a pre-Pentecost environment. What time do we have to quit? Right now? When's this over? 11:20. Okay, we're going to run out of time real quick. And these squares represent the believers that we have. When you look at these pre-Pentecost environments, this is Afghanistan, this is Pakistan, this is most places in China. Most of the movements in China are in just three or four areas. This is North Korea, this is Somalia, this is Yemen, this is Chad, this is Sudan, this is Mauritania. They have never today experienced what Pentecost is like, and their believers are these exes, they're scattered, they're alone, and they are afraid. And our research teaches overwhelmingly what do they need to know about us in a pre-Pentecost environment. There are three things they need to know. What does the Bible say? Who is Jesus? And look at my life as I incarnated in your midst. When you look at the theological emphasis in a pre-Pentecost environment, it's overwhelmingly the first coming of Jesus. They haven't got that figured out yet. Now the problem is, I may be wrong, but I don't think I am. I don't know all of you that personally, but looking at your faces, listening to your stories, everybody in this room comes from what I call now, after this research, a post-Pentecost environment. This is not a bad place, but a post-Pentecost environment is defined by buildings. You emphasize church, not evangelism. 90% of everybody we baptize in the Western world is from the church already. All right? Over in this world, 100% of the people are right out of paganism. All right? You define over here. Here, you have leaders here and in Pentecost, but generally they're lay leaders. They're trained in the local church. In post-Pentecost, we generally send our leaders to school. They get degrees. They're highly literate. They're generally one, the longer a denomination of church exists, the more they generally are one race of people. All right? They're generally not multi-ethnic. And if they are multi-ethnic, generally they're all the same economic group. Okay? These are not bad things. All right? It's just observations. We're in denominations. We fight over everything. You know, do we throw the water at you? We pour it over you? We hold you under till the bubbles come up, you know? Is it a sign? Is it a symbol? Is it a sacrament? We're asking questions. In this world, we will split and divide, start seminaries, and these people never ask those questions. They don't care. And the theological emphasis in this world is the second coming of Christ. Listen to Uncle Ken. Beth, push that second little button up there. Okay, we're going to look at this in a minute. Look at this. In the last 5 years, I've intentionally done an evil thing. Every time I go to church in the Western world, or where missionaries, Westerners gather, I note where the pastor preaches from. 85% of all sermons that I have listened to, been among, radio, whatever, 85% of them have been from Romans to Revelation. And only 15% from Genesis through Acts. Why? Because there's a lot of Jesus in Romans and Revelation, don't get me wrong, but Romans and Revelation is about the after Pentecost has come, after there's thousands of believers. It's about the church. What is the role of women? What's the role of baptism? How do you get deacons? And it's talking about those who are already gathered. 85% of all the sermons we listen to in the Western world are from Romans to Revelation. That's telling, isn't it? My Bible's a little bit bigger than that. And it's an indication that here, we're preaching to the choir, we're not preaching to the lost world, okay? Most of these people are in the Old Testament world. They don't have a clue about gospel and Jesus and Holy Spirit, and we have to bring them along a little bit more slowly. When you look at Pentecost, This is the kind of stuff that we see there that are significant summaries. But the number one missiological issue in our world is that we will prepackage and package everything that we've saved up for 2,000 years and we'll put it on the plane with us and superimpose it over a pre-Pentecost world, giving them all of our divisions before they ever get to Jesus. It's not that this is bad, it's just this is what they need. What does the Bible say? Who is Jesus? How can my life demonstrate for you how a Christian lives and how a Christian dies? That's what we're needing from your students and those that you disciple and send to us. And what we are committed in working with you, both before they leave here and as they get to the mission field, is to share with them how to live and minister in a pre-Pentecost world when that's not been anything they've ever related to. Does that make sense to you? And then we just pray for Pentecost to come so we can get out. All right? When you look at the row of missionaries, Beth, if you would, I have all kinds of hats I put on. That's why we need creative people. My row, my relationship to Muhammad in pre-Pentecost, where he's lost his job, his wife's divorced him, his parents kicked him out, they're smacking him around. My relationship to Muhammad here and my relationship to him when he gets over here to reproducing church is very different. And as I walk into this church that I love, I take on a different persona. There's a different way that I talk, different stories that I tell. And I'm very comfortable. You can go to Cairo and you can find all three worlds within four blocks of each other. You can go in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. You can find all of this within two city blocks of each other. And how we walk creatively in and out of a pre-Pentecost, post-Pentecost, and the world where God's just blowing and going, requires a lot of creativity and a lot of knowledge of God's world and God's Word, okay? I just want to do this commercial. This is the kind of things that we will be teaching in the workshops, what we've sort of learned and packaged from the persecuted. And we're almost out of time. And what I really want to do with half the time is see if there's specific questions or comments that you might have. I really have a heart's desire to deepen our partnership with you in this room. Life Impact has been an unbelievable friend to Beth and I, but we want to do this more than every 2 years, having you in our world and us in your world, okay? Are there questions or comments or something that wasn't clear? Or is it just like a B-52 bomber going over and... It was good. Good question. The lady asked me whether it's okay for me to fight back. From all the research, I could give her about 15 answers, but what I did, I turned to the group of MBBs because I wanted to hear what they would say. And I would say to them, how would you answer this sister? Should she fight back and to her family and friends who are beating her? And they took about 30 minutes talking about who Jesus was, how to turn the other cheek, how to live a godly life, and while she didn't seek the persecution, they were saying unto her, we don't advise you to fight back and to strike back in anger. But what was interesting there, in that group were 30 men, 5 women. The spiritual sensitivity was given by the 4 other women, and the men kept quiet. Because in that culture with those guys, they've been baptized in Jesus, but there's still a whole lot of Arab in them, and you're not going to let somebody smack you and not smack them back. And so they were not at the point where the women were, spiritually. And so they couldn't say, if they were going to be honest, they would say, yeah, Jesus did this and Jesus did this, but if somebody starts beating me, I'm gonna have at it. So the women were much more spiritually mature at that point than the men were. And the women had Bible stories that they gave, and I didn't have to do anything except a very, very small summary remark, because the body took care of her. Appreciate the question. Yes, sir.
In your experience, what is the number one mistake that most short-term teams make in high-security areas?
Seeing themselves as more than they are. Southern Baptists are having a hard time transitioning from going to the responsive areas to going to our world. And when we were in Kenya, South Africa, they could come, be with our believers, do evangelism, do crusades, whether they worked or not. They can meet everybody. In our world, we generally don't let short-termers meet local believers. It's too dangerous for them. And secondly, generally the plight of our MBBs, Muslim Background Believers, is so severe, it breaks the heart of short-termers, and they will start financing them, sending them big wads of money, and helping them come to America. Most Americans are not into church planting. Most Americans are into rescuing. Make sense to you? In Islam, listen to Uncle Nick here. In Islam, when missionaries are directly related to MBBs, we extract to America, Canada, the Western world, 70% of every believer we touch. You can't start a church in Oklahoma City if out of every 10 people came to Christ, you took 7 or 8 of them to another country. So it's not that we're stupid, it's just we just have such tender hearts. And so the bigger mistakes they make is they need to come, be learners, watch, walk alongside missionaries or career people, and get a sense of what God's doing among the nations. What we have churches do in our world the most, our people have no place to play, they have no place to pray. And they get discouraged. It's very difficult for them to stay intimate with God and intimate with their team, their spouse, whatever. And so it's unbelievable ministry when churches come out and go from team to team to team just offering worship opportunities, bringing their praise team out, bringing their pastor out, opening the word in our house. But the biggest mistake to answer your question is they try to get next to believers too quick. Their expectation is that they can be in their homes. They precipitate persecution, and they're not wise in their money. We had a little movement breaking out a year or so ago in Addis, and some money from some volunteers were interjected in that very quickly, and we're having some trouble to recover from that. But that's probably the most general problem is security and the use of money unwisely. And the persecuted oftentimes decry the missionary tourist, the person that comes out for 2 weeks, 2 months, year after year. They want you to come out on short term. They want you to get hooked. But they want you to come back, pay the price of learning the language and culture, and therefore you're not like the wise man in Matthew chapter 2, that in the ways of finding Jesus we mess up. That's been me for many years. I appreciate the question. Yes, sir.
What has your experience been with college students who come for a summer or a semester to describe sort of what they've done?
We can put them in places like universities and stuff where they have really opportunity to minister. From our point of view, we don't say this to college students. We really look at that as an investment in them more than their investment in ministry. But we want them to really see it, taste it, smell it, see what it's like. We want to be very honest with them. In my area, best in my area, I can only use college students in Ethiopia. The other places are too dangerous. When we start using students in our other countries like college students, not college graduates, parents come after us with a vengeance. And we just find the cost effectiveness, the risk, when I do a risk assessment, when they're still in college, under their parents' authority, it's I can't use them in Yemen, I can't use them in Somalia, Eritrea, or Djibouti. The risk is just too high. When they're out of their parents' direct supervision, they can make more adults decisions. We still have parents coming after us pretty hard. We had one mother about a year ago say, I know every one missionary's name in Yemen. I know all your platforms that you're on securely. If you don't leave my son alone, I will write it in the press. I will expose every one of you. That's not necessarily just an extreme example. And so again, getting parents, you see the package deal. If you get parents to bless their children into God's kingdom, we won't have to try to deal. I couldn't take those kids. But I've learned I almost got 5 college students. I missed by about 5 days getting 5 college students kidnapped in Somalia. That will give you extreme gas bubbles, you know. And you start getting college students arrested and kidnapped in our world. They kidnapped, I think, 7 Italians and 5 Germans in the last 2 weeks in Yemen. They all got freed. There was no problem. But you start doing that, the media exposure and what parents will do, it'll jeopardize everything that you're doing. But, Brett, to answer your question, we use them a lot in the university-type settings. When you look across name, they can go to the Moroccos. They can go generally to the Tunisias and the Jordans and the Israels as college students. Generally, Beth and I are in such marginal areas, we got to have them graduates. Now, any family that will come as a family, I'll take bed babies. This is something we haven't done a good job of in Southern Baptist life, is encourage short-term mission trips by families. That's awesome. When families come, all kinds of neat things happen. And in our world, then the lost people can see families ministering and emphasizing college students to come with mom and dad. All of them go anywhere. Anywhere I can get into if they'll come with their parents. Praise God. And occasionally, we've taken college students who have come with you all as their college directors who have had the conversations with parents. But otherwise, it's a risky business.